día voy a hacer otra distinta. Voy a hacer cosas que no hice jamás. No va a importarme lo que otros me digan, ni va a importarme si resultará. Voy a viajar, voy a bailar, 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 quiero bailar. Voy a vivir en el medio del campo y a la mañana me voy a levantar.
Hello and welcome to Accent of Women, a show by and about women from diverse cultures and languages right across the world. I'm Jimena Jimenez, and in today's episode, we are celebrating the launch of Hailstones Fell Without Rain, the very first book written in Spanglish here in so-called Australia. This debut novel by Uruguayan-Australian writer Natalia Figueroa Barroso spans borders, generations, and languages. It weaves together memory, identity, and the voices of women. Natalia is part of the Sweatshop Literacy Movement, a Western Sydney-based collective of writers, editors, and art workers from migrant, refugee, and First Nations backgrounds. Sweatshop has been central in nurturing her voice, supporting writers who are breaking new ground, especially creatives from diverse cultures and languages. We are now going to hear the voice of Natalia at her book launch in Melbourne, which took place on the 7th of August 2025 here in Carlton. Content warning. This episode touched on themes like displacement, sexual violence, and police brutality. Please listen with care and prioritize your well-being. If this content raises questions or causes stress, you can contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit lifeline.org.au for support.
So I was a quiet and shy kid all my life, always watching, always listening, always learning, but my inner voice was always very loud, and it was able to grow because I gave it silence. And lots of people in my life shaped who I am, but there were two women that really stood out. First, my abuela Alba, my maternal grandmother, who was a lover of literature and read widely. Every book expanded her world and worldview, and through them, she became highly empathetic. She was able to feel wholeheartedly and taught me to love in collective, because love requires relationship. It requires socialization and community. It requires honest conversations between minds and hearts. Then there's Mariana Minguez, my mum's best friend when I was growing up. She took me in like her own child while my parents were figuring things out. Mariana was a political prisoner during Chile's civic military dictatorship. She was 4.5 months pregnant when she was arrested by police and was forced into an early C-section. She was handcuffed to her hospital bed with armed soldiers by her side. She told me and her kids that particular story over and over. There were many stories, but that one she kept repeating. And through that repetition, she planted in me the seed of defending human rights. These two women are why I read and why I write and why I speak out. Like when I read today that the IDF targeted and shot Gazan football legend, the Pelé of Palestine, Sulaiman Obed, as he was attempting to get food, I spoke up. Or when I read in October 2024 that Sudanese women in central Gezira state committed mass suicide after either being raped by the RSF or fearing of being raped by them, I spoke up. And when I continue to read about the illegal miners that that are invading indigenous lands in northern Brazil and southern Venezuela, targeting and shooting at the Yanomami peoples at such a high rate that Lula, the current president of Brazil, has called it a genocide. I speak up. And thanks to my abuela Alba and Mariana Minguez, my once shy and quiet self has found her voice. Thank you.
And that's the power of women who raise us. They don't just teach us how to love, they teach us what to fight for. The next question. Your novel spans three generations of women across two continents. How did you give each one a distinct voice and bring their stories together?
So before I even started thinking about writing Hailstones Fell Without Rain, I spent years learning the craft through a mentorship with Sweatshop Literacy Movement. Muhammad's right there. They gave me a solid feedback and tough edits and a lot of support. It was where I learned how to find both my own voice and my characters' voices, how to use language with intention, how to structure multiple storylines. Then once my book was acquired, I had an amazing team at UQP. Ian's here, Aviva's here. And they guided me with care and constructive criticism. I want to highlight both Sweatshop and UQP here, because writing a novel is bloody hard work. And it takes a village. It's often romanticized that we write alone, we don't write alone. I didn't just wake up one morning and go, right, I'm going to just write this highly complex and nuanced novel. No, I did not do that. I first had to learn from and listen to the very best in the industry. That said, when it came to tying all the storylines together, I used a few literary techniques, especially parallelism, to create rhythm and flow between different timelines and places by mirroring them. For example, my novel begins in Fairfield, Western Sydney, and then moves into El Cerro, Western Montevideo. Both are working class suburbs, both places are stereotyped and stigmatized by the media, and both are to the west of their capital cities. That mirroring helped erase these imagined borders between time and place, because by juxtaposing such similar settings side by side, the reader is able to move from one to the other with ease. Another technique I used was anchoring the whole novel around a strong thematic core: women, love and forgiveness, motherhood, state violence, migration, class, colonialism, and how all these things shaped each character's identity. Those themes made the various characters connect and communicate with one another, which made Las Ferreira women flow between time and place. And when I landed on the title, Hailstones Fail Without Rain, everything clicked into place. It's a poetic translation from the Uruguayan idiom, Cayó Piedra Sin Llover, which we use when something or someone unexpected comes to your door or into your life. It's that knock at the door that you really don't want to answer. So once I had that title, I knew each character needed to have one of these moments, Cayó Piedra Sin Llover. And something that will shift their world and worldview and move them into action. So the title ended up being more than just a title, more than a name. It became a poetic and structural device that held the whole novel together. And then finally, to finish off this beautiful question, to make each character's voice distinct, I use specific speech tags. For example, Graciela's English is broken, so I applied Spanish phonotactics to her English words. Since Spanish words generally don't start with two consonants, except for like lluvia, which it's double L, but that's like a digraph, so it makes one sound, so it doesn't count. So what I did was add a vowel in front of these words. For example, stop became estop, school became a school. Street became a street. So being consistent with the phonotactics that I gave to Graciela gave her voice a distinction, and a reader could easily know that she was speaking when they read it, even if I didn't, you know, tag her name at the end.
The detail in Graciela's stop I resonated with so much for those, you know, who perhaps have Hispanohablante background. I certainly resonated with that part when I read it. I actually created a post about it on my social media. I got excited on the spot. And also, we were talking a little bit about creating a whole ecosystem of voices through this novel, which is beautiful. The third question is, parts of the novel are drawn from your own family history, like your dad being imprisoned during the dictatorship. How did you balance the personal and the political?
I'm a product of colonization and forced migration, so everything I write comes from that place. For me, the personal and the political have never been separate. Like my dad says, politics is everywhere. It's in every choice we make or don't make. Even saying I'm not political is a political stance, usually one of privilege and detachment. So when I was writing these characters, their political context was not a backdrop, it was the forefront of their identities, just like it is with me and my family.
It's that part for me, I felt it's confronting but necessary to sit in that kind of truth. Migration, the next question is, migration and identity are key themes, as you've mentioned. How do your characters navigate belonging in Australia?
Yeah, so like many people in the diaspora, they struggle, but they don't assimilate, not in the way that the word is thrown around. They find ways to belong by remembering where they came from and through language, food and traditions. They're always shifting and adapting and remembering who they are. That's why in my novel, Graciela's always drinking mate or has a morral over her shoulder or wearing a poncho, because she's literally carrying Uruguay on her shoulders, no matter where she is.
That's beautiful. The idea of memory being an anchor, I felt that one in my chest. That was good. Next question is, what was the biggest challenge in writing a semi, and I don't know why I can't pronounce this word,
autobiographical.
I'm going to fall off my chair. Autobiographical
fiction.
Fiction, yes. What was the biggest challenge?
So the biggest challenge was actually balancing truth with care. So I interviewed a lot of people for this novel, people within my own family and within the community. And I wanted to honour the characters, and a lot of the stories in the book came through people that lived through different dictatorships. So from Chile, Mariana Mínguez, who inspired the character Isabella, and my father and other people that I interviewed in the community from the Uruguayan community. And they shared these stories with me with great confidence. And I grieved while I was writing them. And even though I fictionalized them because it's not biographical, I still felt a very personal and heavy debt to them. But the people that I spoke to, they were very generous. They were like, gracias for listening. And I can't wait to read your book. And I think that these people had these stories in them for way too long. And so when they gave it to me, it was kind of like a therapy. And I can't wait to hear what they think of it once, now that they can read it. But it was actually an honor to be confronted with such a challenge.
It will serve forever as a piece of legacy. And for you to carry those stories with such respect, It's beautiful. So you may have noticed the artwork on the novel. So this is a beautiful piece of artwork. And of course I closed my phone right before I have to ask a question. So we want to give a shout out to the artist who is Uruguayan, Analia Acosta. And was it hard to choose this design at the end?
So with this artist, I'm a big fan and I've been stalking her for a very, 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 very long time. So please all follow Analia Acosta. And when I realized that she was Uruguayan, I was like, oh my God. And then even better when I realized she was from the north of Uruguay, because my ancestors come from the north of Uruguay, which is near Brazil, and they speak Portuñol, like it's a totally different Uruguay. And so finally, I imagined her in a book, a fantasy book that I had in my mind, right? That it wasn't real yet. But then finally when I got acquired, I was like, oh, you know, I'm so excited. I'm going to present this this artist. But then when I read my contract, I was like, oh, no, I have no say in the artwork. And so I was like, you know, kept dreaming about it, but I just didn't. I was like, oh, I can't do it. But then I realized how lovely Aviva was. And so I did a little sneaky and I sent it to her. And Aviva's so amazing. The first thing she said was, I'm an author-centered publisher. I will try to get this done for you. And we got it done. Thanks to Aviva.
And if I might add, you have a tattooed on yourself, don't you, Natalia?
Yes, I do. So I went to Uruguay while I had handed in, I think, my last edits. Yes, I think I handed in my last edits, and then I went to Uruguay, or maybe not, maybe I'm dreaming that I did hand them in. But anyway, I went to Uruguay, and I was like, I'm going to meet Analia, like I was so happy. And the best thing that I did, because not only is she an amazing artist, she is an amazing person, and we politically align as well, which is very important to me. And I was like, I'm going to ask her, do you mind if I get it tattooed? And she straight away was like, no, it's an honor. And she even came with me. And then we did a little reel, like a book cover reveal. I used all my film skills. I was really happy. I got my nephew to film on his phone. I was, you know, I was in my world. I was exactly where I wanted always to be.
If you haven't seen that, I recommend on your socials, also on the Amiga Mia socials, you can see the cover reveal. You can see Analia. You at the cover reveal, and your niece is in
my
there as well.
My niece, yeah. Lisa, she was, you know, the little actor there as well with her little dog. it's great. And it was
experience.
And it's actually filmed in the beach in El Cerro, which is where the... should I say that? No, I shouldn't. It's in the book.
Oh, we're keeping surprises, yes. Yes, excellent. So we do have some time for some questions. If anyone would like to ask Natalia a question. Be about the novel, could be about maybe challenges with writing the novel, any questions? Yep, absolutely.
I'll just be in Uruguay.
I'll just hand you the microphone.
Hi, Natalia. So my question is, if you could have readers take away one thing from your book, so whether that's a feeling or an idea or anything like that, what would it be?
It's a really good question. If I could get readers to take away one thing from the book, it would be to know the power that they hold, because one person can make a change. In my novel, there's one particular person that is the reason why the dictatorship ended. It's for people that are fearless and will take a stand against the oppressors. So if it's the one thing that I want people to take away, is that know the power you hold and stand up.
Thank you. Great question.
So now we're going to head to a section where we're going to hear a passage from the novel. And then after that, if we have time, we might talk a little bit about the initiative, because we've got time.
Yes.
And then we can head to book signings, and we do have books available here. But just now we'll go to a passage reading.
Electric veins web and intertwine, igniting the night sky. Bright silence. Lightning flashes over Fairfield's orange-bricked buildings and grey-rendered shops, like they're under scrutiny of a police officer's torchlight, hovering from above, flickering, battery about to die. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, boom! Don't move. The thunderclap rumbles over postcode 2165, striking fear in all its residents for a split second. Neighborhood dogs howl from balconies. Street cats bolt beneath parked cars. Pigeons nestle under bus shelters. Families tug at their children in a musicality of languages. Vamos, yala, dina, and so on and so forth. Ming, in a yellow tradie shirt, races past in his silver ute towards his last job for the day, playing boys to men, end of the road, loud and proud, sipping green tea from his thermos. Mohammed stands out the front of his shop, Al-Shakarichi, bakery and sweets, promoting it like a pro. Dyed black hair gelled back, thick gold chain effulent like his grin. Code switching into his microphone from English to Arabic, the speaker blaring his hoarse and grandiloquent voice out onto the rush of pedestrians. The crowd of Fairfieldians cross the traffic lights at Smart and Spencer Street intersections, taking no notice of whether the pedestrian symbol is flashing green or red, pushing their shopping trolleys with their faulty wheels, holding shitload of overfilled plastic bags, bursting into multilingual conversations, not caring for the irate drivers beeping for them to get out of the way. And walking down Smart Street among the organized chaos of Thursday night shopping are 3 out of 4 of La Ferreira women, wheeling their new, to them, second-hand purple fabric sofa on a wooden dolly over the bumpy, overcrowded footpath. To the left of the El Sofá, and holding most of the weight, is stumpy 51-year-old Gracho, dressed in a fluoro pink protective long sleeve shirt, paired with skin-tight navy blue tradie pants that fold at her ankles and kiss her a heavy steel cap tan boots. All eyes follow her, much to her distaste and discomfort. OHS is the sole reason why she ever wears high vis or color, period. Gracho prefers to wear black because she looks damn good in it, plus it hides her belly rolls. Opposite Gracho is recently turned 14-year-old Diana, her middle child, who thinks she holds most of the weight of their lives and absolutely under no circumstances ever wears black. Diana has reminded her mother of this more than once, saying, "Far out, Ma, you only see loonies wearing the color worn at funerals." As Gracho exits her bedroom in yet another black dress, vivid tank tops and torn jeans exposing her muscular thighs and immaculate white dunks are Diana's thing. That and rebelling against authority. In particular, she gets great satisfaction in contradicting, more like educating, her English teacher, Mrs. Hansen, whose snobby tongue tenaciously corrects Diana's bilingual one and its blend of Westie slang and Spanglish, telling her to speak proper, to which Diana reminds her, "FYI, miss, Shakespeare invented over 1,700 words. Use libero italics should know." Wedged between her mother and sister stands 12-year-old Laura. She's barely pushing her end of the couch and knows it. She's too busy reading The Poet X. She consistently gets away with not doing her part of the never-ending chore list because she's the brainy brain and obedient, meaning Laura states facts and speaks truth as her mother tells her what to put on, like the $5 grey Kmart tracksuit pants and blue jumper she's wearing right now. But she doesn't care as long as she has a book in her hands. According to Laura, clothes are nothing more than material to protect your skin from the elements, and she hates capitalism has turned a necessity such as fabric on flesh into a fast fashion frenzy. Every time her mother and sister are taking forever in the bathroom to get ready to go out effing anywhere, Laura will yell out, "Immoderation intensifies indecision, eliminating idiocy." as Gracho and Diana push and shove one another while posing in front of the mirror. Something Laura has noticed while she waits for them to style their hair is that although Gracho and Diana differ clothes taste-wise, they do look alike, especially when they stand side by side in front of the bathroom mirror. Their skin is the same shade of a tawny brown orongo, and their noses are flat like the bulb end of a lambombisha. Their red round lips resembling the plump drip of fruit of a mate plant. However, Gracho's image reflects sherba green eyes and a bushy black afro, whereas Diana's bounces back deep dirt brown eyes and still lake straight hair. Unlike their mother and middle sister, Laura, la bebé de la casa, and Rita, the eldest who left the nest, have bronze ruffled waves and are as paper pale as the pages used by colonizers to print their version of the history of Avia Yala. But dear reader, all Las Ferreira women splinter from the same wood shaft, and that shaft is stronger when they're together, because together they're like arrows in a quiver, waiting to be knocked, drawn, and fired. Thank you.
And this is all we have for today. At Sound of Women is produced in the Melbourne studios of 3CR Community Radio with the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation and shared nationally via the Community Radio Network. You can listen to this episode and past shows at 3cr.org.au on the At Sound of Women page. If you like what you listen and would like to get in touch, email us at atsoundofwomen@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and making the space for these important stories.